my dad just snapped at me and was like, you are going to be honest with me and you're going to tell me how bad it is. And I was honest. I was like, I can't stop. I can't stop and I don't know what to do. And he said, we're going to find you someplace. And if they say that you need to be there 60 days, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think it's enough. But whatever they tell you, you'll stay there or we will take that baby. And all I could think was, I hope you do.
Let's be honest about recovery.
The rewards, the challenges.
Let's talk about our failures.
We are flawed people, after all.
Let's challenge the stigmas that weigh us down.
Because while most of us are looked at,
few of us are seen.
Let's talk about addiction.
And how Christ overcomes our weaknesses.
Because we are loved.
Because we are loved.
Because we are loved.
We are loved.
We are
because
loved.
We are loved.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Jesus Loves Addicts. Thrilled that you're here. Last week, as you know, we had a chance to delve into Brittany's story in part one. And today we go further as she talks about her own addiction and her own redemption. And so welcome back to part two of Brittany's story.
I started to have really bad panic attacks where I would pass out and slam and hit the floor from hyperventilating. I just wasn't good. And so I started working for the coroner's office. Loved my job. I felt like I had a purpose helping these other families who were grieving and going through terrible things. But it kept adding to my list of mental images and that pain. And so I just couldn't hold it together. And I desperately wanted to be a mother and it wasn't happening. And I thought, if I'm going to be alive, I need a little something to keep living. I went to a psychiatrist. I was misdiagnosed after a 7-minute appointment as bipolar. So he said, you can't, I've been on depression medicine since I was 13, since I had been raped. And so I was very comfortable with SSRIs. I'd been on them for 20 years. He gave me 3 new medicines on top of that for bipolar disorder. He said, you can't be depressed and be on medicine, but still having depressive episodes. This is bipolar disorder.
Mm.
Well, it changed how I felt about things. I had 0 inhibitions on these 3 new medicines. So when I started hanging out with a friend, that friend offered me my first Percocet and said, if you crush it and snort it, it will feel like your anxiety medicine has kicked in really fast, but you'll have a little up.
Mm.
I've always been terrified. I watched my mother. I saw her die. Sure. I know all the things.
And that was never going to be you.
That was never going to be me. But I had no inhibitions in that moment. And I immediately was like, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. You say so. I trust you. We'll do this. By the time that several months later, my family came to me and was like, this new medicine that you're on, you're a zombie. You just don't act the same. You don't walk the same. You don't talk the same. We think you should come off of it. So I did. And by the time I had that oh no moment of I can't really stop taking these because I'm snorting them and I'm crushing them, I was full blown addicted. Yeah.
Now, when they had that conversation with you, did they know that you were taking Percocet? They just thought it was the prescribed.
Thought it was because they saw in the first couple weeks of me taking this bipolar medicine, They saw such a shift.
Mm-hmm.
And they were thinking, well, maybe it'll taper out. Maybe, but I wasn't excited about anything. I didn't.
Just
everything was just kind of okay.
Right.
So I started taking the Percocet probably a couple months into the bipolar medicine. And within a few more months, I was addicted to the Percocet and could not stop. But I had such shame that I couldn't go to my family and say, I made a huge mistake. There's something that I need to tell you guys. Because my biggest fear in life was to be my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, and it's opiates, and I can't stop. I'm my mother.
Mm.
And so I kept taking them and took a lot and spent a lot of money. to the point where our house went into foreclosure twice. At the very last minute, we were able to pull it out. And
was your husband aware of what was going on?
He had no idea.
Okay.
He was working off at this point.
So that not just were you your mother, but you were in the same
boat.
This is the family reincarnated.
Mm-hmm. He was working off. I was by myself. And we had gone through fertility and it didn't work. And I was like, it's fine. I'll keep doing this and it'll be fine. And I just won't tell anybody.
How long had y'all tried by that time?
We had tried for 14 years. And then I found out I was pregnant out of nowhere, 2 months pregnant. And I started panicking, thinking, oh no, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
So I tapered down as much as I could and I kept using because I couldn't. I couldn't go to my family, I thought, and tell them they'll be done. They went through too much with my mom, is what I was telling myself.
At a very young age, when you did go to them, you weren't met with what you needed at the time. And that's what you knew.
Yeah. So I thought, I'll just do what I have to survive at this point. I had my baby girl. Thank God. She is wonderful and healthy. And I was hoping that being in the hospital those several days, I have that break of using nothing.
Right.
But I had to have a C-section. And they sent me home with 40 Percocet. And I immediately started to use. Last year, I started running out of money. And so, because I could take 20, 25 Percocet in a day, snorting all of them and not feel out of it.
Right.
I just felt kind of up, but I started running out of money because Percocet's expensive. And so I started drinking with it. All the while, my husband's working off. I have my baby. And my family is coming to see the baby, but I know when they're coming, kind of.
Yeah.
And so I make sure that I'm okay. But I never felt out of control, which I'm sure that my mother never felt out of control. I felt like I was holding it together fine. Percocet made me a better mother. I was able to be up. I was able to not have the panic attacks. I was able to be good on Percocet.
Where were you getting these at this time?
A friend of mine had been going to pain management. And so I was getting them from him and some of the people he knew from there. And when I started to really run out of money, I started to pawn things. I started to drink because I'm really smart. And I knew that if you drank on top of painkillers, the few that I had, it would sort of boost you up to that. It's not dangerous at all.
Not at all. There's not like a whole warning.
There's not a whole warning about, hey, don't drink with painkillers. But one night.
This is sarcasm, by the way.
It is so sarcastic.
Very sarcastic. It's super dangerous. I don't know how my daughter's okay, how I'm okay, how the grace of God is how we're still okay. But I started to steer more towards methadone because methadone is cheaper than Percocet, but you could still snort it. And so I did, and I drank on top of it for the first time one night.
You were buying those from the street? You never went to a clinic?
No, okay. I never had anything besides Klonopin that was prescribed to me.
Okay.
And the 40 Percocet that I got after my C-section. So I started buying Percocet from kind of the same, or methadone from kind of the same group of people, and I started snorting that. But one night, I was not okay. My husband and I were having a hard time. Turns out, I would learn later, we're very codependent. We are trauma bonded to the max. We've been through a lot together. So us being separated with him working off, me having a brand new baby, it's not good for either of us.
I'd like to take a moment to recognize a major podcaster. Today's episode is brought to you by America's Thrift Stores, your go-to option for decluttering and giving back. You have a closet bursting at the seams or a garage that's seen better days? We've got the perfect solution for you.
That's right. America's Thrift Stores makes it easy to clear out the clutter and make a positive impact in your community. Whether you are cleaning out your wardrobe, downsizing your living space, or just looking to give back, America's Thrift Stores has you covered.
And here's the best part. You've got options. Schedule a hassle-free home pickup, drop off your items at one of their convenient donation sites, or swing by an America's Thrift Store to donate in person. No matter which way you choose, you're making a difference.
Every donation you make to America's Thrift Stores directly benefits charities in your area, such as the Home of Grace and other fantastic organizations dedicated to helping those in need.
For example, donations made to America's Thrift Stores in Southern Mississippi help the Home of Grace provide support and assistance to individuals facing drug and alcohol addiction. Your contributions make a real impact on their mission to provide freedom from addiction through Christ-centered recovery. So, not only are you decluttering your life, but you're also helping build a stronger and more supportive community.
It's truly a double blessing. So what are you waiting for? Clean out that closet, clear out that garage, and make a positive difference in your community by donating to America's Thrift Stores.
Visit America's Thrift Stores online to schedule a home pickup, locate a donation site near you, or get directions to one of their store locations.
America's Thrift Stores, where giving back never goes out of style.
Your story, and thank you for your honesty with us, but your story screams codependency throughout. Mm-hmm. So my question is this at this time, is this really where you're just becoming aware of what that is?
I wouldn't learn about complex trauma and codependency until I ended up in rehab. Like, people throw that word around, codependency. And it's like a cutesy sort of, we're so codependent. We just like to spend time together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not that. It is you, when you're not together, you're not okay.
Right.
Right.
So he found ways to distract himself that were destructive. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you said something, Brittany, just to highlight that definition. You said something after your mother passed. Your husband's still working away. You said something that really pins the tail on the donkey of the definition you just gave. You said, my purpose was done.
Yeah.
Right? At that point. So, and what you meant by that was there was nobody around me to fix.
Yeah. Because that was my life.
Yeah.
That was
my whole purpose.
Exactly. Yeah. That was my whole purpose. My sister is married. She is gone.
Right.
She's living 9 hours from me for the first time. I was not. Okay.
Yeah.
My mother is dead. It's my whole purpose. My daddy, God love him, he tried so hard to be there in those moments for me. But he was done with my mom at that point, you know? So when she died, it did grieve him. And he did cry. But he was so done.
He had tried everything.
He had tried everything at that point.
Sure.
And it didn't work. So I felt like, here I am. My whole purpose, I failed at it. It's not just done. I failed at it is how I felt.
Right.
And so I tried to fill that with my job. Mm-hmm. I got a job and I was very good at it. Not one complaint in 6 years. Hundreds of cases of helping families. And it didn't matter on the inside. Then I had this baby, and I'm going to be very honest. I thought she would die the whole time that I was pregnant, because it was like, nothing good. There's always another shoe to drop. Mm. Always. Mom would be good for a while. She would lose it. You know, then she died. Something bad's always coming. I knew every ultrasound that I went to, I wouldn't hear a heartbeat, and then I would. And I'd be so happy for 30 seconds. And then that fear. Then she was born. And I knew, I didn't realize it was postpartum anxiety, but I started to develop these OCD tendencies where I had to touch a bunch of things to relieve this anxiety, because I knew that if I didn't, she would die. She'd stop breathing during the night. So to deal with this panic, I started taking more and more, which, come to find out, after I came off of everything, the anxiety really went down. It really wasn't helping as much. I was like, the more I take, this will kind of
less anxiety.
Well, because you don't learn how to deal with it. Right? You're trying to medicate it away, and that's not what the source of it is, right?
No, and it was making it worse. It was making it so much worse. So my husband started coping in unhealthy ways because he was working off. I had this brand new baby. I wasn't sleeping. I was so ashamed. And if I didn't have something to take, that shame would eat at me.
Mm.
And so I constantly had to have something. And money was an issue. Started taking the methadone, started snorting the methadone. And then for the very first time one night, drank with the methadone. And it hit me differently. I started to spiral mentally, sobbing. I wasn't okay. All these feelings that kind of get numbed with the Percocet were enhanced with drinking with the methadone. All this shame, it was too much for me to bear. So I reached out to my cousin. And at that moment, I wasn't thinking I'm going to kill myself. I just was like, I don't want to live like this.
Mm.
I thought having my baby was going to fix it.
Mm.
I was meant to be a mother.
Yeah,
I've always been a mother. I thought it would fix it, and it didn't.
Yeah,
and I thought, something's wrong with me that I have this beautiful baby that I've wanted this whole time. And I can't stop. I am my mother.
Mm.
So I reached out to my cousin and I said, I just don't know if I want to be here anymore. And I meant that to open a door to a conversation, like, help. I'm an addict. Our house that had come out of foreclosure is about to go back into foreclosure. I've spent all of our money. I've pawned some of my husband's guns because they are so expensive, and and all of this shame and blah, blah, blah.
Can I ask you a quick question? Because you said, I am my mother. Are you telling us this now in hindsight, or did you make that realization then?
That was how I felt in that
in
moment.
In that moment, okay.
That the thing that I had tried my whole entire life.
Yeah, that
cannot be.
She was weak, I felt like.
Mm.
She was weak. She should have loved us. She should have stopped. It's not that hard. Just love us, be okay.
Mm.
It was like a mantra inside me. Just love us. Be okay. Love us enough to stop. And then I looked at my baby and I thought, I'm supposed to love you enough to be able to stop. And I can't. I am my mother. I am my mother. But instead of it opening a door to, like, I'm an addict, my cousin panicked and called my sister, who had moved home at this point.
Home to live with you.
No, not home to live with me, but home from, she had been living 9 hours from me. She had been moved home at this point, and my sister FaceTimed me, which was not a good thing because I had just been sobbing because I'm not okay. And she's like, are you okay? I'm like, just a little overwhelmed. I'm all right. It's okay. And she goes, I'm on my way. And I was like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Please don't do that. Because I wasn't ready to talk to her. I didn't want her to know.
Were you still trying to protect her?
I didn't want that safety gone from her.
Mm.
I wanted to still be that safe person for her, and her not to live in fear of me dying. She saw me on FaceTime, knew that I was wrecked, knew that I wasn't okay. She called my dad, who, if I didn't want my sister to know,
you sure didn't want your daddy
to know. I sure didn't want daddy to know, because I wanted to be everything to my dad. Mm. His shining star who held it together, his right hand. I never wanted him to be disappointed in me. And they both show up, and I'm out of it and not okay. And my cousin had sent them the message that I sent, where I wasn't good. And it looked like I was going to kill myself.
Did you say anything? Did you say anything about substances, anything in that message?
No.
Okay.
No, that we didn't get that far.
Okay.
Because as she should have, she saw that message. She called my sister because she couldn't get to me herself. She was out of town. She was like, I'm getting somebody to you now. And my sister walks in my room. I had alcohol hidden in the closet, but I knew that they knew that I wasn't okay. And so I was going to go into my purse and hide my paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. That's what was important to me in that moment, yeah, is for them not to know that I'm like crushing pills and snorting them. I can tell them I overtook something. But I had Neurontin in my purse. And so I was like, well, I'm going to take two or three of these because, well, now I'm panicked. And so, but my sister walks in that moment, mm-hmm, and sees me taking them, hits my hand. They go on the floor. She makes me open my mouth. It's a whole thing. She calls 911. I end up at the hospital. I don't go in the ambulance because I'm going to be hard-headed and I'm going to fight it the whole way. But my dad takes me to the hospital and he's honest with me and says, he says, your stepmom has been talking to me for a long time saying that you weren't okay. And I just didn't believe it. I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't grasp that you had a problem. You've got a problem. And I just, in that moment, wanted to die. My sister had my baby. I'm at the hospital. And Daddy said, you have to go somewhere. You have to. And I ended up, I thought it was going to be like a 72-hour hold. I was there for 7 days. But that whole time they were working to try to find me somewhere to go. Because while I was in the mental institution, they found out that the guns were gone, that I had pawned them. And they were hurt and disappointed. And my dad just snapped at me and was like, you are going to be honest with me and you're going to tell me how bad it is. And I was honest. I was like, I can't stop. I can't stop. And I don't know what to do. And he said, we're going to find you someplace. You're going to stay there until we find you someplace. And then you're going to go. And if they say that you need to be there 30 days, I don't think it's enough. 60 days, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think it's enough. But whatever they tell you, you'll stay there or we will take that baby.
Mm.
And in that moment, all I could think was, I hope you do. Because I refuse to let my daughter grow up the way that I grew up. So if I can't hold this together, absolutely.
I'll need y'all to do what you threatened.
I called from the mental institution. I made my husband promise me, if I leave early, because I knew I wouldn't want to stay at a rehab. If I leave early, whatever, I want you to try to take custody of Dev from me. Because I can't. I cannot have any out whatsoever. Because if I feel that there's a little bit of weakness and I can come home and I can manipulate my way out of it, I will. I'll do that. So I get out and my husband tells me that he found me a 60-day program and it's called Home of Grace, that it has really, really good numbers as far as people coming out and staying sober and that they've done a lot of research and that's where he wants me to go. And I was thinking, I've never been to rehab before. 30 days is home for, sorry, I'm home for one night. My family shows up because the next week my daughter was turning one. And they had a small birthday party because they were like, we're not giving you a week to wiggle out of this. You're going to go tomorrow. So we're going to go ahead and have a birthday party. We have it. I'm heartbroken. It's awful. The next morning I wake up, we drive to Home of Grace. There I find out it's 90 days, not 60 days.
I mean, probably, what was awful about that?
It was awful because my family was standing around watching me try to hold it together and smile for my baby and take pictures and have these memories and these moments.
So you felt like you were in a fish tank or something? Is that okay?
And knowing that this is the last time I'm going to see her for what I think is 60 days. And that she's only been with me. Like,
since she was born.
Since she was born, she's just been with me. And now I'm going to be gone and I'm going to miss her first steps and I'm going to miss everything. But we come to Home of Grace. I find out it's 90 days because Quinn had been at work and had misheard on the phone. But I had promised my dad that if I backed out in any way, he was supposed to try to take the baby. And so Quinn panics and I was like, are you going to stay? And I was like, you tell my daddy. I did not blink. When they said 90 days, I never even blinked. I was like, yep.
Oh. You were already doing something your mom had not done.
Yeah. That program saved my life because I had not trusted in the Lord in a long time. I had a lot of religious trauma. I had a lot of complex trauma. I had all the things, and there were classes set up that felt like for everything that I had ever been through.
Mm.
And one of those things was codependency and complex trauma. I never really heard about, you know, all of the things that go along with that. And it was like they had put a camera in my house when I was in that class. Like, all the things that I had been a part of, all these unhealthy coping mechanisms that I had developed. And so I spent 3 months by myself with no distractions, going to these classes, only getting to talk to my daughter once every for 15 minutes once a week. And it was hard.
No pain.
It was really hard. But in those classes and in my counseling sessions, I learned so much about myself and processed things that I had never begun to before, and learned that I use humor a lot because emotion was weakness for me. And so if I could make you laugh, it wasn't that bad. Everything's fine. We're fine. I was made to write these letters that were goodbye letters. And I thought, well, of course, I'm going to write one to my mom. That makes sense. But it was these detailed letters where I had to reexamine almost every relationship in my life. And then the last one was to myself as a little girl, because I looked at myself really harshly. I should have done better. I should have been more. But having to then look at myself at those young ages and think about saying the things that I say to myself on a daily basis to that child, you should have done more. You should have been better. Couldn't do that. Yeah. So.
Almost mothering yourself.
Yeah.
In that moment.
Yeah. It sounds really simple to like write a letter to yourself as a child and say all the things that you needed to hear. It broke something loose inside of me that had been so cold and hard and burdened for a long time. Taking those discipleship classes and learning that Jesus wasn't standing there waiting for me to ask for something, only to be an evil genie and give it to me, but in a terrible way. I never asked for anything from the Lord because he was waiting to judge me and hurt me and give me what I asked for, but in a bad way.
Or pray take for, it from you.
Pray for patience. He's going to send you something terrible. You know,
yeah.
That had been drilled into me. Pray for my mother to be healed and God would kill her so her body could be healed in glory. So I was very careful. And I just didn't speak to God.
Yeah.
But having 3 months to just pour over the Bible, to pour over these classes, and start to rebuild myself was imperative. Because 30 days isn't enough. And 60 days wouldn't have been enough for me. And then finding, in the midst of all of that, that I am a good mom.
Yeah.
And I'm a good daughter. And I did my best. Now, coming out of Home of Grace, our counselor made us write like a list of the things that we wanted, the things that we, that were almost unattainable things that we wanted. And I made this list and I read this list. And one of the things that was written on the list that wasn't written on the list was, she said, you know that you probably want another child. Why didn't you put this on your list? And I was like,
why didn't you?
Because it had taken me 14 years to have the first one. I'm 34. I just knew it wasn't going to happen for me.
So it wasn't that you didn't want one. It's
I wanted another baby. I always wanted two little girls. That's what I wanted. Mm. So it was like me and my sister, but in the best way.
Mm. Were you scared to just speak out loud what you wanted?
Yeah. Because I'm like, it's not going to happen. Why am I going to say it? I'm still battling that even today to say the things that I want, because the second I say them out loud, what if that's what makes it not happen?
Right.
I don't know. But she was like, I know you want another baby. And I was like, I do want another baby. And so she told me, she made me ride it, and I did. And I graduated.
Before we go any further, let's take a minute to address the man or the woman listening to today's episode and wishing for a better life. Or maybe addiction has completely overtaken a family member or a friend.
You are not alone. As you may know, the Jesus Loves Addicts podcast is produced by the Home of Grace, a Christ-centered addiction recovery program in South Mississippi with over 60 years of experience.
The Home of Grace has residential programs ranging from 30 days to 12 months. With two separate campuses for men and women, they are fully staffed with caring individuals who want nothing more than to guide you to a life of recovery.
Services include individual and group counseling, marriage and family counseling, classes, workshops, GED, and workforce training, all grounded in biblical principles.
And because of donations from the community, the cost of the program is incredibly affordable.
Thousands of alumni from all across the country can tell you there is no other program in the world quite like the Home of Grace.
If you want to start a new path to recovery, don't wait. Speak with their admissions specialist today. Visit homeofgrace.org or call 833-55-GRACE to talk with someone.
That's 833-55-GRACE. Call the Home of Grace today. Man, your story is the perfect storm, Brittany, right? Mm. Because, and what I mean by that is, right, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, but these two storms converge, right? Yeah. And that's what, well, these two storms converge in your life of codependency and addiction, and dependency. They're both addiction.
Oh, yeah.
Codependency is addiction, as is dependence on substances, right? These two perfect storms, just wow, just really hitting you. And the component of the codependency that I hear you working through in these moments where you're learning to kind of love yourself again is that you learned a little piece of the truth of God, right? There's a point in the Bible where Jesus asks, what's the great commandment, right? Mm-hmm. To love the Lord, the God with all your mind, blah, 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 right? And the second is like, well, I only mumbled through that because I'm going to butcher it if I try to say it all before. But this, and then he says the second is like it. And do you remember what that is?
To love your neighbor as yourself.
As what?
As yourself.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's where codependency is a problem, right? Because we can love our neighbor. We can do all that. Mm-hmm. We can't love ourselves. And so we're out of balance spiritually. Mm-hmm. And then emotionally and physically as well because of that. So I love that pathway back. I hear this piece of you kind of discovering yourself and maybe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I hope this is true, maybe learning to love yourself a bit.
Yes.
Amen.
It's one of the things that I struggled with the most is I can do anything for you, anything.
Sure.
You ask me, and even if it puts me out, I'm going to do that thing. I don't give myself that grace. And so to learn to love myself has been a huge part of my recovery, and to learn who Jesus actually was and how he feels about me,
and not was the God massive. You were raised with.
Yeah, like it, to know how he genuinely feels about me made it easier to love myself, because I thought he was looking and picking at little parts of me that they're not good enough. They're not good enough. Mm-hmm. It's not good enough. And so I just always felt like I wasn't good enough. And to know that he looks at me so lovingly, genuinely, he loves me, made it easier for me to love myself. Not that it's been an easy ride. I always thought you go to rehab and then you're fixed, and it fixes you. You take the classes and you do the work. You give your life to the Lord and you are fixed.
Perfect. Good.
Such smooth sailing after that. But I graduated from the Home of Grace, and it's been hard. There have been so many days where it has been hard, but I have so many tools now that I didn't have before. and I feel my emotions in the moment instead of packing them all down and then letting them come out in a panic attack later. Part of it is being so very truthful every day about the things that I experience, telling on myself always. If I start to...
To who?
To my husband.
Okay.
Confessing those things. Like if I have a craving, I call my husband. I call someone I graduated with. I call my counselor. I pray about it. I'm like, this is how I'm feeling. I woke up this morning and my first thought was, if I had a Percocet today, I could probably get through this day a lot better. Just because that was my thought process for so long.
I want to ask you, for those listening, when you started doing that and putting that into practice and telling on yourself, what did that do for you?
It was so freeing. There's no room for shame because it doesn't linger inside of me to fester.
Yeah.
Like I had this thought about using, I didn't make a plan to use, but it crossed my mind and I had this craving. I should be so much farther along. I shouldn't be feeling this way. I shouldn't. Mm-hmm. There's no time for it because when it happens,
you pick up the phone.
I pick up the phone and I tell somebody. Mm-hmm. I immediately, it sounds silly, but to work on rebuilding trust as soon as I could helped with the shame. My husband's over the bank accounts now, so okay. He sees everything. I'm on Life 360 with my whole family, so they see where I'm at. Like, I go to Celebrate Recovery.
Is that something you invited? That you invited them to be a part of. That's So you're inviting all of this accountability.
Right. Well, it's because I want to tell, I'm somebody that likes things to happen quickly. I want you to look at me the way that you used to look at me. Mm-hmm. And so to do that, I want to prove myself to you. Mm. Now, there are going to be times when I say or do something that's going to come off the wrong way and they're going to look at me with suspicion. And for the longest time, that scared me. But then I was told it's going to happen. It that's part of recovery.
Sure.
You scared them to death.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to happen. That took all the stress out of it. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to mess up. I'm going to say or do something or not stick to a plan that I had that makes them look at me. And so as sort of like a fail-safe, they're allowed to drug test me whenever they want to. Mm. If my dad thinks something's weird, if my sister thinks something's weird, if my husband thinks something's weird, that's completely fine. I'll take a drug test. It's not going to hurt my feelings. I'm not going to be upset about it.
Man, I cannot tell you what a powerful move that is. Mm-hmm. And you just opted to do that. That is such an amazing recovery move. I love that.
Well, it's something we went over when I was in counseling.
Yeah.
Like, what are the things that are going to set you up for success? I'm somebody that if I have wiggle room, I'm going to wiggle.
You're going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to every time. And so I give myself zero outs. If I tell you that I'm going to do something, I have no choice in it afterwards.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. Sort of like showing up today. There was several times that I was like, I'm too nervous and I'm going to do something else. But I said I was going to do it. And if I say I'm going to do it, I have to do it. That's part of my recovery process. Mm. I go to Celebrate Recovery and we go every other week and my husband goes with me because he said it's hurts, habits, hangups.
Yeah.
He may not have an addiction to a substance, but he has hurts, habits, and hangups.
He has the codependency
in spades, just like me.
Yeah.
But what I love about him is the second that I told him about the class that we took, because we followed somebody on YouTube, the complex trauma and codependency, I told him, I was like, it's not just me, that sounds like you. He dove right in.
Yeah.
So he took the whole course too. I come home and now he's implementing the things that he learned through that. And we're doing it together.
That's awesome.
We're doing it together. And so now I'm in such a better place because even my bad days, and I still have them, mm-hmm. my baby is teething real bad. She's got like a head full of teeth coming in. And so we're not sleeping. And any other time I would use something else to kind of give me the up that I needed with her. Even when I'm exhausted. It's still a better day.
Why?
Amen.
Without the shame, without the isolation of using, I'm still connected to everybody in my life. I still wake up feeling better because I don't have the addiction part of it. I'm still an addict, but I'm not using.
Yeah.
I don't feel the way that I felt waking up every morning, having that hanging over my head.
Boy, you have just put a wonderful defining description to a slogan that you'll hear in the 12 steps, which is that you'll often hear them say, my worst day in recovery is better than my best day as an addict. Now, if you just hear that, there are people who are maybe struggling with addiction or even, you know, in recovery who might think, oh, come on, you know, let's not lie to ourselves. We had good times. But that's not what that saying means.
Yeah, no.
Yes, you may have had good times, but they were always a setup. I always call addiction the great con man, right? Anything it gives you, it's only setting up to take away tenfold. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is we trade away the long-term for the short-term gain in addiction.
Yeah.
Whereas in recovery, it's okay to give up some short-term for a long-term gain.
Yes.
And man, you just put such a great definition on that, right? So even when I'm having a bad day, and the thing that really struck out, you said, I'm going to wake up feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in addiction, it's just the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
I may make myself feel better in this moment, but I'm going to wake up feeling like crap. And I don't mean just physically. I mean, emotionally and mentally. And yeah, especially once it really grabs hold of you. So what a great insight to that whole piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I have things to look forward to. I have things and goals. And we're pregnant with our second baby. We tried for 14 years with our first. Didn't think it would happen. It happened. And now we're pregnant with our second. Mm. And I'm tired and I feel like garbage most of the time. I'm going to be honest. But I still feel so much better than I did on my very best day. Like you said, using.
Yeah.
I feel so light most of the time.
Mm.
The majority of the time. I just feel light and okay.
Yeah. And that lightness, correct me if I'm wrong, that lightness is not connected to circumstance,
mm-mm,
right? Because that's what we try. We try to change our circumstances with short-term pieces, right? That lightness is connected to the freedom of not being in bondage to addiction. Yes, this is a tough day, but tomorrow is another opportunity. The next moment is another opportunity.
Right.
This moment is an opportunity to overcome a difficult moment.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
I
wanted to ask you, with all that you went through and to get to the place now you are having that second baby that you did not think you'd have, that you were afraid to hope for, where did that leave you with your mom and how you felt towards her? Because the majority of your story was you were hurt, you were angry.
I am, when it comes to mom, I feel heartbroken for her.
Mm.
She never had peace. She never had the opportunity that I had. Honestly, one of the harshest realizations for me was I was probably 2/3 of the way through my program and it hit me. I just wish my mom could have come here.
Mm.
Because she would have learned so many things about herself. She never felt like she was worth anything. Mm. She never felt peace. She never felt that hope. And it breaks my heart for her. But I'm not angry with her anymore. And I also don't think that she was weak.
Mm.
I think that she did not have the tools that she needed.
She was sick.
She was very sick.
She was broken, like we all are, right?
Yeah.
Without Christ, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think on that road, when you take the time to do the work, to write the letters and to look at it, come into that level of forgiveness and acceptance where you now have compassion.
Yeah.
That does a healing in you.
Yeah.
That was necessary.
It was. It was because she was a huge, huge part of my story.
Mm-hmm.
A huge part of my story. And I look back and I think about, I never thought about what she went through for the longest time.
Yeah.
What she went through before she had us.
Yeah.
Was hard. And so, thinking about what I went through before I had Dev, if Dev was older and she would have been like, you know, my mom, she just couldn't hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
She just could not hold it together. What was wrong with her? But if she knew nothing about my story, she wouldn't have the ability to have the compassion that she needed.
I love the word compassion here because it's so much different than guilt,
mm-hmm.
right? Before, you would think about your mom and feel guilty, like you were failing to mother her.
Yeah.
But that was never your responsibility. So the fact that that has changed now to compassion is really wonderful, right? I mean, it shows insight. Brittany, your story is such, and I know this is going to sound odd in the word I'm about to use, but it's going to be such a gift to others because of where you've come. Because you were, not the specifics, right? I mean, the specific details change for everybody, but you were raised, I think, the way a lot of people are raised, maybe not to the extreme, but with wrongful definitions of things, right? Mm-hmm. So you talked about the church that you were at, which gave you a wrongful definition of the God we serve, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to that point, I would just say, if anybody out there is connected to, and listen, I'm not going to get theological, that'd be another hour conversation, but if you're connected to a church that's making you feel fearful that every time you turn around, God is there to slap you, move on, please. God came to give us peace and freedom. It doesn't mean he's, you know, it doesn't give us a free pass
to do whatever we want.
But he's what he's waiting for is for you to turn and to fall into his arms.
Right.
Right. He's not waiting for you to turn to sock you in the face. But then
and
also,
if I could stop you for just a second.
Absolutely, please.
He's not waiting for us to be perfect enough to love us.
Correct.
That's how I grew up. He's waiting for me to be perfect enough for him to love me and show me grace.
Amen.
He's ready to love you now.
Yes.
And then he will help you be better.
That's right. Thank you for shutting me up.
Sorry.
No, because you just said it better than where I was going. So that is true, right? So thank you for that, Brittany. But then, and then that bled over into, you know, I was writing as you were going. There were so many wrongful definitions. So it started with who God is, and then it became what relationship is, right? Mm-hmm. There was this wrongful definition of what relationship was, and we talked about the codependency, and I'm so glad that you brought that in. I think it's something that gets overlooked. But here's this person growing up thinking that relationship is only as good as I can do mm-hmm. for the other. Of course, in a healthy relationship, we want to do for each other. Again, I'm not going to go into the details of that, but for you, it was all about that, right? So, let me stop there because that can get long-winded. But I just kept writing these things down as you were being raised with kind of wrongful definitions, and then how much more beautiful it makes where you are today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really hope you stand on today as well. It's just how beautiful that turnaround has been because, you know, one of the things you guys don't get to see, and I don't, I just met Brittany today, and I wish you guys did too because her story is so heavy, right? There's heaviness here. But the first thing I noticed about Brittany was her sense of humor. Now, we've talked about how that can be a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you just spent almost 2 hours with us talking seriously about this shows me that that even has now been put into balance.
Yes.
Right? You haven't lost the beauty of the humor. You've lost the false purpose of the humor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And wow, just such growth. And I just want to say to anybody, you know, listening that this is what recovery is. And it's a 180. If you're caught in your addiction, it's a 180 from what you're going through now. When you wake, you know, your addiction is going to offer you moments of clarity. You're going to wake up in moments and go, something needs to change. That's the truth, right? The problem is by the time you lay your head on the bed that night, you may have forgotten that truth. Hold on to those moments of truth. Hold on to those moments of clarity. Reach out, ask for help. I beg you. And I also ask that if you know somebody who may need to hear these stories, maybe somebody's caught in it, maybe somebody's early in their recovery and they're struggling, right? We hear these folks talk about how recovery is not some magic wand. Life is still life. You're gonna have struggles. If you know somebody in their addiction or in early recovery who could benefit from hearing these, guys, please share this podcast. There's no magic here. It's just the beauty of honest storytelling. And so if you know somebody that can benefit that, please point them here. And if you like it, please like and share. Again, I want to point you to JesusLovesAddicts.com. You're welcome to leave questions and comments and you know, tell us what you think. But this is really what we hope is that this is really an opportunity to see the truth about both sides
of the addictive journey, the addiction and the recovery, the absence of God and the presence of God, right, ultimately. And I don't know that that's entirely a true statement, but we'll work that out in future episodes.
The separation and the isolation in addiction, and just that we don't recover alone. And like Brittany shared, it's that accountability. She has a network now. And if you are in early recovery, you don't have to white knuckle it. You don't have to do it alone. You will have more people than you will ever know that are willing to meet you where you are.
That's right. So all this to say, guys, we're really glad you were with us. Brittany, we're so thankful that you came on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And we'll see you next week. Thanks so much. Take care.